So I've got three kids, 12, 7, and 3. I've got a wife, Kelly, who's a graphic designer. She's actually, she was a double major, fine arts. We were both painters. And then she actually decided to get a degree in which you could actually pay bills after getting the degree. So she's got two degrees. She graduated cum laude, Dottie. I graduated, thank you, Lordy. And that's an old joke. That's an old joke. So, but it is true in our case. It's also it's true in our case. I lived in a little town in eastern Washington state called Omak. If anyone knows where that is, I'll be highly surprised because even people who live in the state of Washington don't know where it is. And I went to a school of about 8,000 students, a little teacher's college in the middle of Washington state, called Central Washington University. It's kind of the Yale of Eastern Washington. Thanks. And this is a good group. They get the crowds. Even the little subtle jokes they're getting. That's good. We're going to have a good time tonight. So anyway, God got really a hold of my life during my art years at Central. I mean, really, really got a hold of my life to the point where I felt a couple times like I just wanted to give up on my studies. So now I know that everyone feels that finals week. This was different. This was like a God thing. And I said, God, you know, my real heart and my passion is to start new Chi Alpha groups. I think that's kind of just what I've been made, you know, just knit in my mother's womb to do. And so that's kind of what I do. I was so serious about it that I just told God, here I was a little art student at Central Washington University. I told God, I said, God, I'll go anywhere. I mean, I will just go anywhere you want me to go. I'm so serious about this, God. I'll go to Oregon. I mean, that's how serious. I said, don't send me to California, though, because here I was this little small town kid and this little tiny no-name college, and I just thought, California, you know, there's no parking, it's all traffic, it's total smog, you know, that's where the Brady Bunch live. I just don't want to. That's an old joke. You won't even get that. But the thing is, I don't want to go to California. Well, I spent about 10 years here in California, and my first 2 years were at a place called Cal State Stanislaus, another high-powered institution. And I was at Stanislaus a couple years, and God did some good things there. And then some of the powers that be invited me to come to the University of Pacific and lead the Chi Alpha group there, and then also give leadership to the Northern California Chi Alpha area, the district we would call it. And at that time, I really did not want to live in Stockton. Now, I don't know how many of you have visited Stockton. It's starting. Stockton's getting better. But at that time, it literally was the per capita murder capital of California. More murders. I tell people outside of California that it's like Oakland without the good points. It's just not a really a safe place. And I literally said to my wife, don't worry, babe, we won't ever move to Stockton. Well, I spent 8 years in Stockton, and after about 4 years in Stockton, the national director, Chi Alpha, called me up and said, and God had just done some good things, and we were able to start some Chi Alpha groups out of there, and he called me up and he said, Kurt, would you consider coming to Springfield, Missouri, and planting Chi Alpha groups all over the country, kind of coordinating that? And in that conversation, now, he's a guy named Dennis. He was here last week. You guys met Dennis, some of you. And he's from Texas. And then he's lived in Missouri 20 years. Now, he doesn't really have much of an accent unless he gets tired or excited. And he was really tired when we were talking on the phone this conversation. And he said to me, yeah, I didn't get any sleep last night. They kept sounding off the tornado sirens. Now, for those of you who can't speak Southern, that's tornado sirens. And I thought, did he really just say tornado sirens, tornado sirens? And I thought, there's no way I will ever live in Springfield, Missouri. I mean, at that time, Jesse was 2, and I got this image of Jesse moving back to Missouri, you know, spending 10, 15 years in Missouri and growing up there, and come running in the house one day and say, Daddy, Daddy, a twister's a coming. Get in the basement. And I was like, no, I will not raise my children in this state that has no ocean next to it. This is a sin. You can't go to a place where there's no ocean. You know, that's not right. And so anyway, I've been there 5 years now. My new prayer, my latest prayer is, God, I refuse to go to Hawaii. Won't go there, don't want to go there. Doesn't seem to be working on the same level. I want to tell you one story tonight to illustrate something I think is very, very important, especially I think to your generation, to the current generation of college students in the world right now. And it has to do with this realm of faith. And I just want to ask you this question. How many here have ever had a very important decision that they had a really hard time making? Anyone say, you know, you're accepted at two different schools, or maybe it's a relationship decision, or maybe it's a financial decision. I mean, you don't know what God wants you to do. Has everyone been in that place? And you just, that place where you really need faith. And sometimes you even know what to do, but it's just a matter of the courage to do it. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you felt like God was really distant to you. You know, I go through these seasons where I feel like God's really close to me. And then I have these other seasons where I feel like God is so distant to me. And I had this season like that in my life a few years back. And I don't have time tonight to tell you all the different variables that went into this season and made it like this. But it just was this horrible season where I just felt like God was 10 million miles away. Someone said to me during that time, "Are you having a hard time hearing God?" And I said, "No, I can hear His deliberate silence. I hear His deliberate silence." And it was just a really challenging season in my life. My mom got very ill. My father-in-law got very ill. I had some vocational problems. Everything just started going crazy. And all of the trials of this season came together to result in me moving back in with my mother. Now, maybe in your family, living with your mother at age 36 is a good thing. But in my family, it's a total loser thing to do. And I spent 1 year living with my mother at age 36. And my mother is a dear lady. She's a very, very sweet, wonderful lady. But the problem with moms is, no matter what you accomplish academically, no matter what you accomplish professionally, no matter what you accomplish personally, you are always 13 years old to your mother. You are just 13. You move back in and mom is telling me to wash this and put this away and do this and that. And what made it even worse was, while I was living with my mother, she didn't want to criticize me directly because she is a nice person. So she would just kind of passive aggressively sort of do things, like she would leave little highlighted articles from Time magazine on my bed about nutrition and finances and stuff. And it was just so infuriating. And then, of course, you know, I had two kids at the time and I have a wife, and you're trying to raise your kids in front of your mother. And of course, your mother is the all-time world's expert on raising children. And it was just a really loser season in my life. And one of the things about me is that when I was an adolescent, I was very, very clumsy. Now, if my wife was here, she'd be laughing right now because of the whole use of the word "was." And I feel like I've become much less clumsy, but there's some controversy there. Well, anyway, when you hit adolescence, things change. Your body changes, your voice, if you're a guy, changes, and you get hair and all that, things happen. But for me, the first part of adolescence, the very first thing that happened to me is one night I went to bed and I had little elementary school boy feet, just tiny little nice boy feet. And then the testosterone wash went through my body and my feet just, they just got huge. I got these man feet before my body even grew to. It's the same exact size feet I have now, but imagine me 12 years old with these feet. I literally had to kind of walk like this to bring them around. And my mother has one prize piece of furniture that she really likes. She doesn't have a lot of great things. She has one prize piece of furniture. Hey, Glenn, you know, I lost myself. Go ahead and go to the next sign. And so she has this one prize piece of furniture, and it's an antique oak table. This antique oak table, it's got beautiful antique oak chairs and these beautiful, big, huge leaves that we bring out during the holidays. And this table, my mom raised six children and it had gotten all scratched up and marred. And she saved her money and she paid a very expensive antique restorer guy to totally refinish the whole thing. And they had driven 30 minutes down the road to this guy and put the table there. And he had had it actually for like 6 months, just meticulously restoring this beautiful old table. Well, the day came when the table was completely finished, and the guy called and said, come get your table. And so my mom was very nervous about me helping my father bring the table home because of the clumsiness factor. Now, being that she was nice, she didn't go to me. She went to my wife, and she said, you know, I don't want to seem critical, and I want to think that Kurt hasn't changed through the years, but if you could just mention to him to please be extra. And my wife said, don't worry, I don't even have to say anything more. So she came to me as gently as she could, you know, as careful with my ego as she could be. And she said, you know, when you're getting the table, and I just was immediately offended. Now, I don't know if you're like me, but in a stressful period, in a stressful moment in your life, the little things you can really, like, you know, you're having a stressful week and your roommate smears jam on the counter and doesn't wipe it up, or, you know, doesn't put the toilet seat right on you, you know, or maybe you got one of those roommates that, I had a roommate that snored. I mean, I just tell you, I literally would keep small objects near my bed to throw at him, you know, I'm like, Dana, stop snoring. And it's the little things that can really, really make you psycho. Can we just say that? And just something about my mom criticizing me and saying that I was clumsy with her table. It just, I said, I cannot believe this woman. I am not 13 years old anymore. I am a man. I'm 36. I've had a few successful jobs here just because we're in this moment of transition. Blah, blah, and I just went off and vented and got all prideful and confident and verbose. And my wife's like, just settle down. She just said, be careful with the table. I said, no, this is blah, 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 blah. And I just got all full of pride. Got in the truck. My dad, of course, my dad, he doesn't say anything. You know, Dad, he stays out of the controversies. So there's no talk in the car. We drive 30 minutes, complete silence. We get to this antique refinisher's place. I'm acting like I'm being really casual, but actually the criticism has worked because I'm on my extra best behavior. We pull right up to the loading dock. Get out of the pickup truck. I jump up on the loading dock. I go in the back room. The table's there. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. We pick the table up extremely carefully. We load it in the back of the pickup truck. We surround it by all sorts of cushions, all sorts of blankets. We tie the table down. It's loaded. It's tied. It's perfect. It's cushioned. It's precisely wonderful. Not a single scratch. I wipe my... See, my mom. I can't believe she criticized. See? I'm 36. I know what I'm doing here. I'm a man, not a boy anymore. I go to get in the truck. I'm ready to celebrate the victory of showing everyone how not clumsy I am. I sit in the cab, and just as I'm about to sit down, my dad says, oh, the leaves, the little leaves that extend the table. We forgot those. Oh, I'll go get them. You move the truck. I'll get them. So I run back in the place, run back in the rack room. I say to the guy, hey, we forgot the leaves. Oh, they're in that corner. I go back there. Four big, huge, heavy, antique oak leaves. They're four big planks, long, you know, 4-foot planks. I say, well, I can make two trips or one. Well, one trip. I pick them all four out. I come out to the thing. It's a November morning. It's crisp, cold, eastern Washington State November morning. By this time, my dad's moved away from the loading dock. He's kind of pulled around getting ready to get out of the parking lot. And so I think, I'll just go down that sloping ramp. I'll just walk down the sloping ramp, and I'm walking towards the ramp there. And just as I'm about to hit the ramp, I say to myself, hey, the cement on the ramp is a different color than the cement on the platform. That's interesting. Now, we have this little thing in eastern Washington that you don't have here in California, and I find it has one good purpose. It kills bugs, and I like it about that, but everything else about it I don't like. The little thing is a thing I like to call winter. And we have that there in eastern Washington. And the thing about winter is it causes this reaction in water in which it will take the solid form, otherwise called ice. And they call this thin sheets of ice on the ground, they call it black ice. Because it changes the color of the surface that it's on to be a little bit more black. And this is what exactly is happening. I look at this black ice, my brain doesn't register what it exactly is, and my heel hits that ice, and I immediately go into a Warner Brothers cartoon moment. My feet just fly way up over my head, and my head just goes bam, 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 right on the cement. I mean, okay, this brother right here, I'm just like, feel right there. Ooh. Am I joking? Am I not joking? It's like my twin brother right there. Boom. Just bam, I hit that cement. And then the worst part happens. Because as I fell, I just threw those four planks in the air. And my whole world went into slow motion. Now, here I want to tell you this. If you don't get anything out of this little talk, beware slow motion. Nothing good in your life happens. When you're in slow, and the next time you're in slow motion, it'll probably be when you're about to wreck your roommate's car in the parking lot of, you know, Target or something. You know, you start to pull out and you can see that you're going to pull right into the guy who's trying to pull in, and all of a sudden your life just goes, whoa. And you can think 1 million thoughts in slow motion. You're like, oh no, did I pay my insurance this month? I'm not sure if I paid it. Yeah, I do. I remember paying it, but there's a $500 deductible. Oh no, I'm going to have to spend $500 in a millisecond. You can think all that, and bam, there's nothing worse than the sound of metal changing shape unintentionally. And this is what happened to me. I lay down there in slow motion, and I thought, oh no, all of my sort of trying to act all cool is going to be for naught. It's going to be clear to everyone that I am still a complete uncoordinated dork. I am about to ruin the carefully finished antique leaves that my mom has paid hundreds of dollars to have refinished. And just then, all four of them hit. Bam, 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 bam. Right on my forehead. Oh. Piled off of me, scratched up, dented. There was like a quarter inch big dent in one of them. My dad, he's a nurse anesthetist. This means he's not an anesthesiologist. He's a RN who got anesthesiology training. Nurse anesthetist that basically passes gas for a living. That's an old joke. So anyway, he runs to my side. My dad runs to my side, gets down on one knee. Are you all right? Are you all right? He's checking my vitals. I mean, literally, he's worried that I just have killed myself. Are you all right? I finally regained my sense. I'm okay. Are you all right? Yes, I have a horrible headache, but I'm all right. Are you all right? I said, yes, I probably have a mild concussion, but I'm going to be fine. Are you all right? Yes, I'm all right. Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. Good, because I just have to laugh so hard. And he just started busting up. He couldn't stop laughing. All the tension, because of course, you know, Dad knew about the whole conference. He could not sleep. He's just breathing like he's going to have a hernia, you know. We get in the truck. We drive 15 minutes. He pulls over to laugh some more because he can't laugh and drive at the same time. We get into the house. He walks in. He's like... My mom says, how's the table? And he said, well, the actual table's fine, but the leaves are back at the refinisher being worked over again. And I just, every single thing that I wanted to prove to my mom, I absolutely did the most convincing thing I could do to unprove it. The very absolute, you know, go ahead and go to the next slide, Glenn. The thing about my life is, I have an incredible gift from God. You see, I collect embarrassing moments like most people collect stamps. And the beauty of that, the grace of that, is that it helps me really understand essentially something extremely important about faith. You see, I think faith is, for all the talk that we have in church about faith, I think faith is greatly misunderstood. Matter of fact, as I travel around the United States talking to college students, and especially college students that are unchurched or not Christians, I've found that there is profound misunderstanding of what faith is. And I find even among Christian students, our understanding of faith is often not very articulate. And even sometimes slightly heretical. What really is faith? I mean, the Bible says without faith, no one can please God. The Bible says that faith is crucial to hope. And we all need hope. The Bible says that faith is the essential, it's the catalyst for receiving everything that God has for us. And there's a lot of bad teaching on faith out there. There's a lot of people that use and abuse faith. It amazes me that there are some preachers that can take the most sacrificial act of all history, the death of Christ, and turn it into a means for selfishness by teaching about faith and prosperity. And I think that bad teaching on faith exists in the vacuum of no good teaching on faith. So what is faith? What is faith? And how does doing stupid things help you understand what faith is? Well, first of all, I'd like to talk just really for about 5 minutes what faith is. And go ahead and go to the next slide. Faith is not emotions. I think a lot of times this is the biggest misunderstanding that I run into students. All times students say to me, you know, I'm not going to believe in God because, you know, I like to examine things from an intellectual point of view. And already they're telling me that they believe that faith is emotionalism when they say that. They say, you know, I'm a logical person. I'm not a faith person. And they use that as two sides of the spectrum. But the truth of the matter is, faith has nothing to do. There is no verse that says, and when thou passions rise up within me, and you begin to tear up and wave thyself. You ever notice people that when they cry, they have to wave some of them? I didn't want to cry. There's no verse that says, thou shalt wave thy face to get more oxygen as faith moves upon thy. And, the, you know, that doesn't. Okay. It's usually girls who do that, but okay, guys, guys, you are not, because I see guys do this as far as emotionalism and faith goes. They get hernias for Jesus. You know, it's like some, you know, you have a big test coming up or you really need God to do something in your life. And so, like, you might even, like, be praying with a friend and they'll say, okay, I'm going to pray for you. And this is what a guy will a lot of times do. If they really want something from God, if they really need a lot of faith, they'll do this. Okay, God, I really need. Go, God! I receive it! Whatever you have for me, God! Tell me the answer! You know, it's like, you're not receiving from God, you're giving yourself a hernia. And it's not, it, all of that is, you know, I had a friend once who was in a particular version of Christianity that's heretical, that's a sect of Christianity that I don't think is right, and we were debating and debating and debating, and he said to me, well, even though you're making a lot of sense, and even though I can't answer your questions, I know what I believe is true because I have the burning of the bosom. I got the burn. And I said, my bosom burns too. One of us is heartburn and one of us is wrong. You know, it's not, you know, we can all believe passionately and still be wrong. Now, emotions are good. And if you have a hard time expressing emotions, that's not a healthy thing. Emotions are good. Emotions are great. God gives emotions, and emotions are crucial to healthy Christianity and healthy life. But they are not faith. They're not a foundation of faith. They're not an ingredient of faith. They're not a catalyst of faith. They're just emotions. They're a gift from God, like food or finances. They're wonderful, but they aren't faith. Go to the next slide. So faith isn't emotions, and it's not... you love my slide. Isn't that great? I stole that off the Harvard website. Harvard Medical School. Just mined it right off their site. So, but I gave them credit right there. But anyway, do you ever notice that people can sound smarter if they talk with a British accent? You can say, you know, the most inane things, but if you say, you know, what the church needs to do today is just wear underwear on their heads all the time and paint their bodies orange. You know, okay, let's take notes on that, you know. And I will not do this a lot of places, but it's true that if you talk in a southern accent, no matter how smart you sound, if it's a southern accent, you sound dumber. E equals AMC squared. You know, it just sounds dumb, no matter what it is. How fast do you move in the theory of relativity to exceed the speed of light? You know, you can't make it sound smart. And so a lot of what appears to be intellectualism is really kind of that old story of the king's clothing. It's not really... And, you know, we have people that think the more information that you have, the more faith you have. You know, if I just memorize the whole scriptures, if I just get all the... And if information in and of itself produced faith, if information changed us, if education alone were the answer, no one would ever eat McDonald's ever again. Because we all know it's bad for us. You're not eating that burger going, there's amino acids... antioxidants. I mean, you're not doing that. You are actually thinking, I can feel, yeah, that ventricle. I can feel it clog. Supersize it. You know, you know it's not good for you. There's not a heroin addict on the face of the earth. It's like, it's vitamins. They know it's bad for them. The information alone will not give you the power to actually change. And so, again, intellectualism is great. Being informed Christians, being intelligent and intentionally intelligent is essential to authentic Christianity. But in and of itself, it is not the foundation of faith. It does not produce faith. It is not the catalyst of faith. Go to the next slide. I'm talking too long. But so we don't, emotionalism doesn't do it, and intelligence doesn't do it, and neither does empty habits. Glenn was talking about his Anglican background, and I I came from a Catholic background, and we were Christmas and Easter Catholics. We went to Mass twice a year. Anyone here been to Mass? Anyone here know what Mass is like? Okay, so in Mass, you sit down and you stand up, and you sit down and you stand up, and then at one point, you kneel, right? Right? There's one kneel in the service. Okay, so I would always bring my non-Catholic friends, and it would be sit down, stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down, stand up. And when I got to the kneel, I'd be going like I was going to sit down, and then go to the kneel at the last second. And then, of course, my friends would just sit down. Oh, no! Is lightning going to hit me? I didn't, you know, and I'd be like, gotcha! You know, and, you know, what I've found is there is not, this word liturgy Glenn was using, it just means an order of service or how, in what way you're going to do things. And some people take liturgy very seriously and other people are very casual. But I found there are some people that believe their religious gatherings don't have a liturgy. But it's really not true. All of us, no matter what stripe of Christian we are, we have a liturgy. And the question is, there's dead liturgies and there's living liturgies. There's liturgies that are infused with faith and there's liturgies that are habit. But the habits in and of themselves are neither good nor bad. And they don't in and of themselves produce faith. They're a separate issue. They can assist. They can help. But they are not faith. Just because we dress up the outside and go through the motions doesn't mean that there's been any real faith transformation on the inside. So it's not, go ahead and go to the next slide, it's not emotionalism, it's not intellectualism. And this is one, there's a big picture of him, huh? This is one that a lot of Christians I don't think get. Faith is not about confidence. It's not about confidence. Faith is not about convincing yourself over and over again, it's true, it's true, it's true, it's true, it's true, it's true. It's not that. Matter of fact, the thing I love about Christianity is that it's the one world religion, the one monotheistic world religion, I'll say it that way, that embraces the concept of doubt as a virtue. You say, prove that, Kurt. Certainly, Matthew 7:7. Jesus says this, the foundation of his ministry says this, ask and you'll be answered. Seek, and you'll find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. In other words, Jesus is saying this, the Father is not intimidated by any question, any doubt, no matter how hard that question is, no matter how profound that doubt is. God does not fear doubt. And in fact, I believe to be a Christian means to start from the place of saying, I don't know. Not to start from the place of saying, I'm absolutely correct. It's the humility, the contriteness of saying, I need help. Not, we're right, you're wrong. There are convictions in Christianity. There are core beliefs that must not be compromised. But they are not presented ever in a way that's arrogant, overconfident. That's not faith. Peter says it this way. Let everyone know the reasons for your hope. But do this with gentleness and respect. I love the story of Nathaniel. Nathaniel was an intellectual. He had a friend named Philip. Now, Philip, he's in the Gospels four times. It's a beautiful little thing because all four times in the Gospels, Philip is asked a question. He has no idea what the answer is. This is Philip's claim to fame in the Gospels. He's the I don't know disciple. You know, what is the I was going to study. I got busy and then, you know, my mom called and there was a lot of things. My roommates got pizza. I don't know. You know, that's Philip. Nathaniel, he's following John the Baptist around. And John the Baptist says one day, okay, you're all fired. There's another guy, Jesus. He's going to start hiring in a week or so. Why don't you go follow him? I'm shutting the house. And Nathaniel's like, what? You see how many people show up at the river today? We're having a ministry here. So that kind of confuses him. He goes to the place where in the Near East you go to think things through, and it's actually a place where there are a lot of times even the classroom setting, so to speak, would be, and that's under the fig tree. So Nathaniel camps out under the fig tree, and he's doubting. He's thinking this all through. He's trying to figure out this change between John the Baptist and Jesus because it's not all making sense to him. Philip, on the other hand, he's that sort of charismatic guy who he's not really asking the big questions. He's just pumped about Jesus, and he's already sold. And so if Jesus is about to leave town, down, and Philip says to him, wait, my friend is not here yet. And Jesus literally says, he says, okay, I'll wait for him. So Philip runs to Nathanael. He says, Nathanael, Jesus is heading out of town. Come on, let's go. And Nathanael looks at him and says, you goofy little sanguine boy. Don't you realize that the Messiah must come from Bethlehem and Jesus is a Nazarite? He's from Nazareth. He's a Nazarene. And Philip looks at him and says, that's a good question. It's a really good question. And Philip repeats verbatim a sentence that Jesus had said to him the day before. He just looks at Nathanael and says, come and see. Come and see for yourself. And Nathanael gets up from the fig tree and walks to Jesus. And Jesus looks at him and Jesus says, hey, Nathanael, you're the guy that has no manipulation in your personality. And being a person of no manipulation, Nathanael goes, that's right. How did you know that? You see, Jesus isn't mad at the doubter at all. He's not mad at the doubter at all. In fact, you see, you almost hear this delight in Jesus when he meets Nathanael. This joy. He's not mad. He's not like, how come you weren't here at the first day and we almost left you? None of that. He embraces him. And then he says this. This is the part that's so profound and wonderful and incredible. He says, hey, Nathanael, today when you were at the fig tree, I saw you. Now, he could have said, I saw you at breakfast, I saw you at lunch, I saw you when we went to the bathroom, when you were brushing your teeth. But Jesus said, hey, Nathanael, I have supernatural knowledge of the fact that you were sitting at the fig tree today. And what Jesus is literally saying to him is, hey, when you didn't believe in me, when you were not sure if I was the real deal, I still believed in you. You see, God's not afraid of doubt because he's sovereign. He's sovereign. Let's go to the next slide. Talking too long. What is faith then? So if faith isn't emotionalism, if faith isn't intellectualism, if faith isn't empty habits, or faith isn't extreme confidence, what is faith? Well, I want to say this disclaimer. I cannot in 30 minutes explain to you the subtleties of faith. I believe it's an eternal quest to figure out exactly what faith is. But fundamentally, it's not that hard to understand. The depth of faith goes on and on and on, and we can understand more and more and more. But fundamentally, it's not that hard to understand. And it's completely different than this sort of emotionalism or information and education, these sort of things I've been talking about. And go ahead and go to the next slide. Faith is a lot like makeup. Or if you have a really good mother. What do I mean by that? Not everyone will understand the makeup thing, but there are a few. You ever meet someone who likes to put on makeup? You ever know? There's some. My wife doesn't put on much makeup. She's not a girly girl. She's kind of a patchouli, denim-wearing hippie girl, and she didn't have any precious moments collections or pink in her wardrobe. But for some reason, there was a latent gene or something. Our daughter Emma will not wear anything but pink. This girl is a pink-wearing girl. I mean, she'll just scream at you if you don't put pink on her. And her aunt made the horrible mistake of buying her a little makeup kit. And she puts it in a little white purse, this daintiest little feminine, sexist. I mean, it's just like, you know, we were both like not hardcore. We were big, you know, feminist types. And she's wearing this little patent leather purse and a pink dress. And she's got makeup in it. Drives my hippie self nuts. But anyway, the point is this. She's got in this purse this makeup and she wants to put it on the street. She wants to put it on every day. I'm like, one morning, it's so bad. One morning I woke up Saturday morning. I had been traveling the night before. I got home really late. And of course the dogs and the kids are all in our bed on Saturday morning and it's noisy and the TV's on and the cartoons. And so I'm trying to sleep in a little bit and I can feel something on my face. I'm like, what is that? And I wake up and my Emma, my 3-year-old, is right over the top of me like 2 inches away. She said, Daddy, I give you makeups, Daddy. And she's putting rouge. I got lipstick. I got this full on me. But, you know, I have known a few students, none that I can tell are in this room tonight, but they won't go out of their apartment, their dorm room, without their makeup on. Or I know students that will not make a single decision without consulting their mom first. Do you ever notice that? I had a roommate who called his mother every night. Every single night. Hi, Mommy. Okay, you're 21. Cut out the mommy thing. And just, he's calling every single night. And she was a great mom. That's probably why. For me, okay, I make fun of other people. I'll tell you what mine is. It's the cappuccino. At 3 p.m, I need the cappuccino. You know, about 2:30, it hits me, and I lose the fruits of the Spirit. They just go away from me. And people come to me, and I'm like, don't speak to me now. I will have the fruits in a few minutes. Let me get the... In Missouri, they have no good coffee. It's coffee purgatory. Because, see, in World War II, they told them to ration the beans, and then no one told them the war ended. And there's enough beans now. There's plenty of beans in Hawaii. They're making them all over Latin America. We got plenty of beans pouring into the country. Use the beans to make a dark see-through coffee. And I just need a dark cup of coffee. And if it's an extra strong cup of cappuccino with some foam that's stiff up in there, oh, yeah. I don't need a whole gallon of milk. I need a little bit of cappuccino. And I depend on the cappuccino. I depend on it. Or you ever find people that are addicted to text messaging? You know one of these people? Have you met these people? There could be 10 good friends all around them, and they're not talking to any of their good friends. What are you doing? I'm text messaging in China. You know, they've got thumbs that have tendonitis. You know, they know where, you know, every symbol is at. You know, like how to hit all this. I could do explanation, dollar point. You know, they could do it. They're just text me. Or this is the worst one. The people that are completely addicted to the email. Did you ever work in an office or someplace, a computer lab where the email server goes down? And, you know, there's some people, it's like email server goes down, end of the world! You know, you can tell these people because, like, they judge their importance in life on how much is in their inbox. Got 4,000 in my inbox. 4,000 unread messages, you know? Only 3,000 of them are about Viagra. I mean, you know, some people depend on the email. They depend on the email. So what do all these things have in common? Mothers and makeup and coffee and computers and email and text messaging. Go ahead, Glenn. They're all things that we trust. You see, faith is not about what we feel. It's not about what we know necessarily. It's not about the habits that we do fundamentally. Faith is about choice. You see, I run into this concept all the time that people say, well, I'm a person of faith. I'm not a person of faith. I've had students say to me, you know, I don't believe in anything that I can't see. And I'm tempted to say, I don't say it because I'm not. I'm tempted to say, well, I don't believe in your mind then because I have not seen that yet. You know, but this idea that there are people that, you know, exist in the realm of facts and there are people that exist in the realm of faith and that those are opposites, that's a complete misnomer. Faith in the Bible sense is about what we trust, what we hope will happen, what we invest our risk-taking in. Every single person operates by faith. I look at this chair right now and I see that the chair is made out of some metal and that it's got bolts in it and that the chair is connected to this other chair that also looks sturdy and that the whole apparatus looks like it's fairly sturdy. It's in a nice arc. It's got a decent base. It's bolted to the ground. I've been on many other campuses before with this type of chair and almost every time I've sat in this type of chair that has worked for me. So I'm taking all that information in and I'm also at the same time just intuitively thinking I'm willing to take the risk because emotionally I'm really tired and I want to sit down. And so all of that is working together, but none of that in and of itself is faith. Faith happens when I make the decision to trust or to not trust the chair. And when I take the weight off my feet right now, I exercise faith. Because there's a moment in there where I don't know for sure. People often ask me, hey, Kurt, you're a Christian. Do you know for sure God exists? And I say, you know what? No one knows anything for sure. But I have faith in God. And there's a moment when I sit in that chair where I have risked that it might fall apart the second my weight hits it and I might just fall on the floor on my patootie. But everything I observe and know and experience led me to be willing to take a risk and to have faith in that chair. So the question is, go to the next slide. The question is not, do you have faith? The question is not, do you have faith? I'm a person of faith. I'm not a person of faith. The question for life is, whom do you have faith in? You see, it's not really even the stuff you're putting faith into, because computers and coffee and chairs, that really doesn't matter. Really, the deeper level of it, the more important question is when we start taking risks with each other. It's the relational risk. Who do you have faith in? Do you have faith in John Kerry? Do you have faith in George Bush? Voting for one or the other is an expression of faith. There are not people of faith and people not of faith. It's a question of who do you have faith in? Now here's the problem. Here's the challenge in that. I was talking to someone, really extremely talented person, and we were talking about this concept. And I asked her. She's a person who works 40 hours a week at a very important organization. She's also a full-time student, straight A. She's never gotten any other grade other than an A in her whole life. And she's got really, really big ambitions, lots and lots of pressure from her family to do well. And we got done with this whole conversation, and I said, who do you have faith in? And this is what she said to me. I have faith in no one. Now, she's a person who's a Christian, too. She said, really, literally, if I think about having faith in no one, I said, that can't be true. You got to have, everyone has faith in something. You can't just, it's not a question of what, it's a question of who. And you got to, she said, okay, I can see that logic. She said, okay, I have faith in no one but myself, and I'm on my bad list. Because she realizes that she's infallible, that she doesn't always make the right decisions. With all of her talents, all of her skills, all of her smarts, all of her passion. See, this is what the Bible says. Go ahead and go to the next one. He who trusts himself trusts a fool. You see, I said everything I've said tonight to get to this one slide, and that's simply to say this. Who do you trust? See, I don't think it's arrogant to trust in self. I think a lot of times it's just the default decision we make, because we know we can't really trust that friend, that professor, that family member. So bottom line, in the real day-to-day practicality of our life, we often end up trusting ourselves. The problem with that is that it's a very, very risky thing to do, not to mention really, really lonely. Very lonely. I offer Christ to students with this simple exhortation. Test him and see if he is not more trustworthy. Test him and see. Be that Nathaniel. Sit at the foot of the fig tree. And even if all your questions aren't answered, follow. And beware, beware, beware of trusting yourselves. Let's close tonight in prayer. Father, I thank you that these busy students have had some faith in me tonight. They've given up some of their time to listen, consider what I've had to say. I've tried my best to articulate so much. And I'm sure that I have failed to do it justice. But God, I ask your Holy Spirit to make this a starting point. Teach my friends what authentic faith is. Lord, I pray during the next set of midterms. I pray during the next set of finals. I pray during that next really hard season in their lives, that next challenging moment when they need to take some risks, when they need to make some big decisions. I pray that they would lean upon you and you alone. Lord, don't let the pride, the hurried nature of this world fool themselves into trusting themselves. God, don't let them get any lumps on their heads from falling from trusting self. But instead, I pray that they would invest their lives in you. And I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, thanks for hearing from me tonight. And I hand it back to you, Mr. Glenn.